طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. The Palestinian narrative is most genuine and most powerful when Palestinians tell their stories of resilience following the ethnic cleansing of their land by Israel in 1948. The love of their land and the hold that that love has over their lives resonates generation after generation, even for those who now, years later, live in the diaspora. This love of their land and culture is the driving force behind their resistance to occupation. We came across an interview of Dr. Ahmed Abdulmajid, who now lives in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He is the son of refugees who were driven out of their Palestinian village during the Nakba in 1948 and fled to Gaza. They moved from Gaza to Qatar, where he was born, then to Canada before coming to the United States. Ahmed is now a pharmacist and his wife a nurse. His story is so typical, even though he has been in the diaspora most of his life. Here is how he handles his identity as a Palestinian and a Muslim. The interview takes place at the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace and is conducted by its director, Dr. Michael Spath.
We really have a special treat today because we're speaking with our own Indiana Center for Middle East Peace board member and friend, Dr. Ahmed Abdulmajid, who identifies himself on his blog, among other things. I'm not going to list them all, Ahmed, but Palestinian, Muslim, American, coffee addict, Nutella fiend, pseudo-writer, interfaith ninja, intellectual vigilante, and undisputed king of snark. So anyway, Ahmed, we may get to one or more of those, but
I do have that out in public. So
I'm not sharing anything you haven't already shared publicly. And I'd also add, of course, the host of the well-received, very important, I would say, podcast based on his very popular TED Talk, The I in Immigrant. So Ahmed, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
68 years ago, my home was no longer free. I became a refugee. 68 years ago, I was forced to live in three foreign lands away from my grandfather's love and my grandmother's caring hands. I couldn't bury them, nor in their funerals stand. 68 years ago, I became a victim of colonization. I was hit with a somber realization that although I'm the victim here, I need to live in fear. 68 years ago, I became a refugee. 68 years ago, I became me. Talk to us a little bit about that poem and what it meant to you and what it still means.
Well, that was written on the 68th anniversary of the occupation of my homeland of Palestine. It's just a reflection that I believe a lot of Palestinians do share, which is the fact that our home was taken away from us by an invading occupying, that continues to occupy and continues to expand government. It was the Zionist forces that established the state of Israel. And I think in that moment, I just wanted to bring to whoever reads it, bring to their attention the humanity behind the label. And that's really, humanizing the label has been kind of my personal mission over the past few years. Once it crystallized in my mind that what we do is a lot of times associate quick shorthands to a label that define the person who carries it, my intent from that and all other work has been to give a voice, give a face, give emotions to that label. And so the label in that particular poem is Palestinian, that carries different meanings. When I grew up in the Arab world, its understanding of the word Palestinian to coming to Canada and then the US and the understanding of the word Palestinian or what it carries or the, you know, the complexity behind it or just the emotion that I get when people say, well, it's complicated and I can't really comment or I can't really understand this. So it's a way to give life to a label that not a lot of people delve deeper or go beyond.
I want you to expand upon that, but in this context, virtually every time you're interviewed, you're asked to share your story, you know, your family story from Palestine to Qatar to, Palestine, Yibna, and then Rafah, then to Qatar, then Canada, and then to the U.S. But you now just mentioned something that really intrigues me, and you talked about your personal mission. So tell us your family story and your personal story, but then also this growing sense in you as you matured, as you moved, this growing sense of this personal mission and how each place kind of helped to form and shape you in this personal mission of yours.
Yeah. So in, rather quickly, the story is my father was about 8, my mother was about 5 when their hometown of Yibna, Palestine, was occupied by the Israeli forces, and their hometown was basically ethnically cleansed, so they all had to leave, and they left living in Gaza for a short period and then settling in Rafah on the border with Egypt, and getting a refugee travel document issued by the government of Egypt. That's how my father eventually traveled out. I think he might have been 19 or 20, I don't remember. Traveled out of Rafah, went to Qatar in the Arabian Gulf, got a job, and then went back, married my mom, and they started their family. So all my siblings and I, and I'm the youngest of 5, were all born and raised in Qatar. But in Qatar, you live there as a resident of the country. You never become a citizen except in certain circumstances or where you have a higher up who's interested in the work that you do or have connections within one of the major sheikhs in the area. So we lived as residents dependent on my dad's employment. Basically, if he loses employment, then he has to find another job within a certain period of time. Otherwise, we had to leave the country. So he always lived with that sense of the place where you were born and raised is not home. And don't get me wrong, they were generous growing up, free public education, free public health and all of that. But again, that sense of this place, I can't call this place home. So for my parents, the understanding of higher education is our ticket to freedom, our ticket to getting established somewhere. And so all of us have post-secondary education, university and college degrees. And that's how I found myself in, you know, Canada and the United States and getting my degrees and living here. But
how old were you when you came to Canada?
18, actually, after high school. I started off actually in Cleveland for about a few months, and then we got the landed immigrant status in Canada, and because my father was trying to get us to move to get us papers in Canada, and we got it. And I moved to Canada for about a few years, and then moved to the U.S. in 2000. So I always had a sense of or a question of who am I? You know, growing up in a place where, again, this is home, but it's not home. And coming again to the U.S. and wrestling with my identity, you know, going through the culture shock, going through college, education, being exposed to a lot more than what I was exposed to growing up. I found that I needed to center myself in identifying or understanding who I am. And then the growth that you alluded to happened over the years and over engaging and interacting with other people, realizing that who I am is not just one thing. And there are multiple layers to my identity and intersectionalities of my identity or my identities. I think I'm blessed in the sense that I'm in tune with that and understand that, and took advantage of my ability to speak about it with comfort, not feel embarrassed or annoyed by the question or anything like that, to try and relate that to others who may not have similar experiences, or again, may just say, oh, he's an immigrant, and that's it. It gives them one particular image in their head, to talk about the intersectionalities. And that intersectionality touches upon many different people from many different backgrounds and walks of life, but there's a very shared commonality in whether it's the struggle or the success or the experience that expanded my ability to see beyond just me as a Palestinian or me as a Muslim.
You know, you mentioned this. I wanted to ask you about that. You've been interviewing immigrants now in Northeast Indiana. You're part of a community, not only Muslim immigrants, but others. And now you've taken this to the next level and you've begun this podcast, The I and Immigrant. And as you pointed out, although each story is unique, say a little bit more about the commonalities and the immigrant experience in our community. What have you learned from these podcasts about the uniqueness, but also the commonalities?
Well, I mean, the uniqueness, I think, is in each person's story and their expectations of what living here would be, or how it would turn out, or their idea of America. And I think the commonality is in the experience. And it's not to say that the experience is negative or extremely positive or this, that, or the other, but just the fact that we all struggle with homesickness. We all, to various degrees, but it's present in a lot of people. And I think in the recap episode where Katie Anderson and I talk about the interviewees, I shared that one of the not the the shockers to me, but one of the ones that I'm like, I caught myself not realizing that I would react that way, was to Irene, who's Italian. Yeah. Italian, Christian, white. Nowadays we speak highly of the Italian accent and the Italian culture and all of that. So I thought that she would have a much easier transition and an easier way to just, assimilate and everything than I would. And I found that it was very similar to a lot of the experiences that I've had and others have shared with me.
You're talking about Irene Poxia from Amani Health, Amani Family Services.
Yes. Yeah. So, again, I've learned the I think deep down the emotional aspect of the immigrant experience is very much shared the same way, maybe at differing levels of intensity, but it's shared across the board, regardless of where you come from.
What have you learned about your Muslim brothers and sisters at the UEF and in other mosques? I mean, I know you're close with the folks at the Burmese mosque as well. Some of them are professional people with professional careers, positions, jobs. Others are not. And what are you learning from them as well about their experience? I mean, I'm sure that they are different in some ways too.
And they are. And, you know, actually,
I mean, language, for example, for you is not a problem. Irene, maybe not, language was not a problem, but for others, language may be the first obstacle that they're facing, you know?
And it is. And especially, you know, if you've come here as a refugee or seeking an asylum, and it wasn't something that you prepped for beforehand, you know, learning the language to come in and go to school or something like that. And that's an obstacle, but that's an obstacle that, in a way, easier to overcome. You know, you learn, even if you learn enough just to get by and to get through your day to day. What I'm learning is, you know, all the, so for example, when I spoke with Abdel, who's from Chad, a Muslim young man from Chad, there are the immigrant issues and concerns and questions and whatever, but on top of it, he's also a black young man living in the United States. So that's an added layer to complexity for him. Or Hamza from Yemen, or, you know, others that you talk to from Pakistan or Afghanistan, you know, haven't had them on the podcast yet, but will in future seasons. And so the issue I think that's common across the board from all who I talk to is, how do I handle the pressure of getting acculturated or assimilated or knowing my way around this new life, but on top of it, all the negativity that I'm facing, and especially over the past few years. So the sense of intrigue of, oh, where you're from, is now a sense of where you're from, that, you know, I want to value you based on the place in which you came from. And that adds a whole lot of pressure. And you're talking, you know, as a Muslim, and the negativity surrounding Muslims ever since September 11th, and the heightened negativity, I would say, that adds a layer of pressure. To me, it's something that I've, you know, been here for about 24 years. I've dealt with it. I can navigate it. I can talk about it. But to someone who's newer to the country, or someone who's not, doesn't have a good handle on the English language and is unable to express him or herself, that causes other added layers of complexity to their experience here.
I want to pursue this line just a little further, if you don't mind. Obviously, you know, for those of us who were born and raised here, oftentimes it's easy to think about refugees or immigrants as a basically just changing of geography, but you're reminding us that you're not just crossing national borders, but there's psychological, emotional, and political, racial borders that immigrants and refugees are facing too. So say a little bit more about maybe the political boundaries that you have to cross, and if you want to say more about the emotional boundaries, that's great. But political and social boundaries, and maybe something about maybe the resources that are available in town, maybe organizationally, but also maybe smaller, more personal resources for immigrants and refugees in our community.
So those are about four questions in one, Michael. Yeah. So I'm going to try and remember to answer them all. So I think from the emotional standpoint, there's always, and I know I'm using absolute terms, but, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but there's always that sense of an emotional response or reaction. I mean, one of the things that I've talked about and talked about with others is that every single day there is that thought in my head of, I'm just going to pack up and go. And even with someone, you know, I Qatar is the place I was born and raised, and I understand fully and logically that it's not my home, because I was, you know, told always that it's not my home. But I always had that sense of, you know, I'm just so burnt out, I'm so tired, that I just want to go back. And in my head, it's going back to my high school days with my high school friends and how simpler life was. So it's tainted in that sense, but there's always that sense of, I just want to go back. And it varies in intensity based on what's going on during the day or the month or the political arena or the religious arena or whatever. So that on the emotional, you never really leave that baggage behind. There's always that sense of nostalgia, that sense of homesickness again. But, you know, it's an emotion just like all other emotions that you have, that you learn to live with and understand and deal with in your day-to-day life. As far as the political, I think you mentioned, again, there is one of the things that I think is a big issue for us in the United States and a big issue for us as a society that we need to overcome is simplifying complex issues to one or the other, black or white, this or that, us or them. There is so much gradient in between option A and option B. There are so many layers to it that we don't... that if we don't spend the time and energy to understand, we create a much more divided community. And that division that we've, again, has been heightened over the past few years, takes its toll on, again, the camp in which you fall. So if you fall in the camp of Afghanistan Muslim, you're carrying the brunt, or you're dealing with the brunt of the political discussion, and, you know, others' understanding of the dynamics there, and they don't see you as a human being. You know, that's what I talk about is that I have worries and concerns about my kids' future, about our health, about home, about money, about taxes, about this and that and the other. But on top of it, I have to worry about people back home that we, you know, our government's thinking about starting a war with, or people back home that our government support the government that's invaded it, you know, in the particular case of Palestine. Or also worry about the response of people that I talk to who are fed one or the other, you know, as far as how to view me as a Palestinian Muslim or an Afghanistani Muslim or Iraqi Muslim or Iraqi Christian or this, that, or the other. So there's always that added layer to the person who was not born and raised here, if that makes sense, when we talk about the emotional and the political. And so the political consequences or ramifications are beyond impacting me as an American living in the United States, because I have family in Palestine, I have family in Qatar, I have family in other places. So there's a lot more, I'd say a lot are more attuned to our international politics as well, beyond just the national rhetoric.
I want to press you a little bit more about this, the immigrant status in the U.S. Over the years, I've taught classes in world religions, maybe 30 or 40 different classes, and always I include a unit on a particular religious tradition in the U.S. And this has been my contention, that immigrants to America, there are two streams. Both are true. One, you mentioned immigrants and their idea of America and why they come. The two streams are these. On the one hand, as they acculturate themselves to American cultural practices, norms, traditions, and mores, they want to become part of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And so America imprints itself, American values, mores, it imprints itself on the immigrant communities.
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, by their very presence here, our immigrant communities with their various cultures and languages and ethnicities and religions, they help to shape the future of the American experiment. In other words, they imprint American culture with now a new, more expansive view of what America might be, what it could be. So America imprints itself on the immigrant community, and new immigrant communities imprints itself and changes the face of what America can become. Talk to us a little bit about those two streams.
So when I moved here, again in 96, the term that was peddled is that the melting pot, that America is the melting pot, that you come in and you become American. I never understood what American is, you know, because so the term that I like more and I think is more or closer to reality is a mosaic. We have each piece on its own is beautiful, but when you put that piece in the bigger picture is a lot more beautiful. So I don't lose myself as an Arab American Muslim immigrant living in the United States and becoming an American. I don't lose my identity or who I came from, but I'm changed. My thought process about certain things have changed. Certain elements and views of life have changed because of being able to live in the United States. So I'm beautiful on my own, but when you put me in that mosaic, that bigger picture as one piece within that America, the picture is a lot more beautiful. It's a lot bigger. It's almost, you know, and as a piece, I'm not an island on myself. I'm interacting with others and I'm part of the whole. So to me, it's, I influence and I'm influenced. I think there are opportunities here that in the United States, and everybody thinks of opportunities in economic sense, but opportunities in ability to express, ability to convince, ability to reach other people that are not available in different countries or other places, that having this ability here is how I influence and I'm influenced. So it's dynamic. It's always definitely an interactive piece. It's never the melting pot. I mean, I think early on we tried to make it into a melting pot, come here and these are the ideals that we value and but that's just not sustainable. And I think the fact that we have that flexibility here to be an interactive piece is what makes us unique as an experiment, as you refer to it.
We have a question from our friend Victoria Gibson. I'm going to just read what she wrote here in the question and you can respond. In the early 80s, 10 years after the fall of Saigon, Fort Wayne had a sizable Vietnamese refugee population. They're now in their second and third generations in our community. Have you had the opportunity to speak with immigrant families who have later generations here and how they're faring? I mean, I'm assuming she's asking not just for the Vietnamese, but for any of them, how they're faring in their second and third generations.
Stay tuned for season 2 and 3. So season one of Dying Immigrant, and I'm hoping, you know, I just talked with Katie Anderson, and WBOI is still very interested in continuing the work. The first season was talking with the immigrants directly, and obviously there are a lot more that I haven't interviewed yet. Season two is shifting into still conversations with other immigrants and maybe outside of just Northeast Indiana or Indiana, but also shifting to the family and family dynamics. So the spouse of an immigrant, the child of an immigrant, you know, my wife, her dad is Dutch, came to the US when he was 24, and then she's married to me. So she's the child of an immigrant and the spouse of an immigrant. So her dynamics and her family idea or ideals are different, you know. So I want to interview these folks as well, but also moving further down the interviews, ideas, and lists is to talk to someone who's a third generation, fourth generation, what of the original culture do they hold on to and what values do they keep, and so on and so forth. So yes, great question. And yes, I hope to get to that. If you're asking from the podcast perspective, from personal interviews and or personal discussions and conversations, yes, but maybe more of the second generation, haven't gotten to third and fourth to talk more about, you know, how far removed or close they are to the origin from where they came from.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about your faith. But from this perspective, as you know, because you're on our board, Indiana Center for Middle East Peace is at our gala next month is presenting our Community Bridge Builder Award to the Muslim Alliance of Indiana, based in Indianapolis. It's an organization that you know real well. And we as an organization were presented with their Interfaith Excellence Award in 2015. Yeah. I want you to tell us a little bit about what it's like being a Muslim in America, in Indiana, in Fort Wayne, but also about maybe how you see Muslim values aligning with American values of diversity and equality and freedom, and how you see them in alignment, not in conflict.
Yeah. I see a lot more alignment than conflict in a lot of ways. On the personal level, you know, faith is challenging, I think, regardless of what faith you're in nowadays. A lot of people are moving away from organized religion or structured religion. So there's that overall pressure, if you will. So being faithful is one thing, being faithful within the Muslim faith is again an added layer. So it's challenging in the sense of, you know, I grew up with one particular understanding of the religion, while there's a lot of diversity within the thought. I mean, the foundations of the faith are the same. The, you know, Muslim prays the same way across the board, wherever you are, you know, these things. But there are gradations in the gray matter issues and questions, and learning that there are more answers to one question than one answer was something new to me that I experienced moving to the United States and seeing Muslims from various walks of life. So to me, it's a constant growth approach to my faith that I'm thankful for. While I've seen it with others where they completely freaked out by it and the instability of it and just said, I don't want anything to do with it, and just completely gave up on the practice of the religion or the religion itself. As far as alignment of values, you know, the values of freedom, the values of sanctity of life, the values of family unit, these issues, you know, I can do that here and prosper with it, and you know, it's in alignment at least with my understanding of American values. And I think there was a second part to your question that I'm trying to remember. Sorry, Michael, could you remind me of what you asked the second?
You don't have to remind me, actually.
I think you were asking about...
are you finding it to be amenable to... I mean, America's been welcoming Indiana. You kind of thrived. You've been a board member of Muslim Alliance of Indiana in the past and other Muslim organizations, not just here in Fort Wayne, but statewide, right? I mean, so it's been a welcoming place for you.
It definitely has been. It's been a welcoming place. I have not had any issues or obstructions at the mosque or even reading the Quran at the governor's iftar in the state house in Indianapolis. Not to say that it's all rosy and there are no challenges. There definitely is, but not in the same sense of flagrant discrimination or flagrant, you can't do this here. That I have not experienced, or if I have, there I can count them on my fingers over the past 24 years. But I think you were asking about alignment of Islamic values with values of equality, of equity, of appreciation of the worth of the individual and all of that. And yes, I find a lot of alignment in that. I draw a lot of inspiration in the work that I do from my faith. So, you know, my work in diversity and inclusion and talking about, experiences of people other than me. So if we talk about, you know, experiences of a black person in America, I can relate. I will never understand it because I'm not a black man living in the United States, but I can understand it and surely understand the basic requirement of being treated equally. Prophet Muhammad in his final sermon, he said that, you know, explicitly that there is no difference between a black or a white or, you know, an Arab and a non-Arab. You know, the only difference is piety, and piety is a matter of the heart, and that's in the hands of God or God's evaluation of one's piety. So the treatment of one to the other is not based on skin color, not based on origin, but rather on respect, mutual respect, and you know, valuing of the other's humanity.
Well, amen to that. I read a poem from your blog earlier, but I want to return to Palestine for just a second. You and I have talked before about traveling with me to Palestine, or, you know, traveling together to Palestine, and you've said that you've had reservations, how you long to return to Palestine, and I'm not sure you used the word afraid, but you're afraid, not in terms of being in danger, but mm-hmm. you're afraid that you'd want to stay back in Palestine once you got there. Talk a little bit about the tug of war in your heart about heading home to Palestine.
And I've had that conversation with you and with others, and my nephew in particular, who likes to go every couple of years. I think that what I'm afraid of is having the whole situation materialized to me personally.
Because you've not been, I should tell everybody here, you've not been to Palestine.
I think I was 2 years old when, you know, my parents took me there, but no, I have no experience as, you know, cognizant experience of being in Palestine. Again, I think I was 2 years old. And so I know how emotionally attached I am and how I react emotionally to the situation. That what I fear is that if I see it in my own eyes, I wouldn't be able to walk away or turn around from it. One of the things when we talk about some of the other things that I talk about, vulnerable and underserved patient populations and people in poverty and healthcare and issues like that. And one of the things that students that travel to countries that, you know, are way worse off than the most impoverished person in the United States. And what I've learned from working with them and talking to them is that they need debriefing before and debriefing after, because the shock of seeing that, the awakening that it has in them, if left unguided or uncoached, could consume them. You know, I remember 15 years ago or so, one of my technicians, when we were in a hospital, and she joined the mission, and she came back completely distraught by the experience. And thankfully, we chatted over a few times, and she grew to understand and appreciate the experience that she had, and gave her a life mission in different ways of helping those who are less fortunate. But for me, what I worry about is that there's no amount of debriefing or coaching or guidance that's going to help me overcome what I would see with my own eyes. And that's what scares me.
How do you plan to address that fear?
I'm just going to have to do it one day. So I don't know if it's in a year or in 10 years.
Talk to me. I know you have family there. You still have family there, right? Extended family.
That I don't know when was last time I spoke to any of them, to be honest with you. They're like cousins of my parents, or even second cousins of my parents. Most of my family have left because of Yubna being occupied in 48.
Well, you know, you have friends here on this screen, and you have friends in the broader Fort Wayne area who would travel with you and who would be support and who would offer you affection and love while you were traveling there and undergoing the feelings that you were feeling, you know? So I just want to, I've said this to you privately, but I'm saying it to you publicly now too, man.
You're putting me on the spot. I'll just call you and I'll say, just say it. But yeah, it's, I like to be aware of what I'm doing and where I am. And that awareness tells me that right now, I don't think I can handle that.
Sure. I hear you. I hear you. And I respect that.
I appreciate that. But I appreciate all the people that tell me about the experience that they have with you too. Thank you for that.
We'll do it sometime. Yeah. We'll do it sometime. It's obvious though, that, when you talk about homesickness, you talked about, Qatar, you know, because you talked about, when you think about this, you want to be back with your friends when you were a teenager, but you also carry Palestine as home in your heart. And, in some ways you have no place to call home. In another way, you have many places that you call home. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you about one of the things that I, when I moved here 20 years ago, was try to get to know as many interfaith leaders, mm-hmm. leaders of the different faith communities as possible. And you know that we have a real rich set of different faith traditions here in Fort Wayne and Allen County. In fact, 20 years ago, we were, and earlier, Fort Wayne was called the City of Churches, and more now, right, it's becoming the City of Faiths. Mm-hmm. And we're really appreciative of that kind of evolution. And I know that that's been something that's been close to your heart, your interfaith work. And I know it's been something that you, with the Iftar with Mayor Henry, who's held an Iftar, hosted one along with the Muslim community. Talk a little bit about your interfaith work and the importance of your relationship with various faith leaders and other leaders in the secular movement, leaders of people with goodwill. Mm-hmm. So talk about that part of your personal mission.
I think in many ways that talking about Islam in particular crystallized after September 11, where whether I like it or not, whether it's intentional or not, everything I say, everything I do is being viewed as a representation of the faith. If you look at my Strengths Finder profile, and I've been taking that Strengths Finder for the past 15 years or whatever, the number one strength, I guess, that I have that never changes, you know, the top five always switch and whatever, is responsibility. I wish I could shake it off, but it's never changed. It's always responsibility. So I felt a sense of responsibility to be able to speak to the faith and to speak about the faith in the sense of, I'm not here to tell you what Islam is not. I'm here to tell you what Islam is. And, you know, speak to the understanding of the faith as it's understood by its close to, whatever, 1.8, 1.9 billion followers across the globe, and not be tainted by the actions of a few. Again, humanizing the label and whatnot. So that led me in many ways in learning more about the faith, for me to learn it more, but also to be able to speak in a manner that others can relate to and understand. And as I was learning and growing into that, I understood more and more how closely related we are as differing faiths, especially if you talk about the Abrahamic faiths and Christianity and Judaism. And that similarity is something that we all need to be reminded of. And in particular for me as a Palestinian, you know, the conflation of Judaism and Zionism, or the conflation of Judaism and Israel and the Israeli government. Yeah. You know, showing that my issues are not with the faith of any particular individual, but my issues are with an occupying government that's apartheid, that's expansionist, that's colonialist, that you know, is killing people mercilessly, and so on and so forth. So to tease that away from the faith, which unfortunately in a lot of people's minds, it's the two are interrelated, and to say, no, this is not a faith issue, this is a political issue. So that, you know, got me more and more involved in reaching out, in talking with other faith leaders of the Jewish faith, of the Christian faith, and the various denominations within both. And we all share, you know, this bond of we care for our communities. We care for the humanity of our communities. And I think that's the layer where we connected outside of the faith with secular groups, more on the equal rights, or the, you know, people that even they may be religious, but they will tell you that I'm an American. American is a secular government. And so I don't want the conversations to revolve around religion. I want it to revolve around our ideals of government that we've established from early on. So once you find that common thread, it pulls you in more and more. And for me, that common thread, I think came about through my recognition of I'm being in the spotlight to speak about my faith, and to speak about my faith with comfort and with understanding my own limitations. I'm not a scholar. I didn't study theology and so on and so forth. And just to speak to the common person. And that led me into a lot more of the interfaith work.
We're winding down here. The hour has sped by. I just have a couple more questions for you. I thought this was very moving, and I know it moved you too, and it moved you not only in your heart, but it moved you to do some reflecting about the state of affairs in America. And so let me just relay this story back to you that you related on Facebook just about 3 weeks ago, as well as on your blog. You were working at a pharmacy, and a young black teenage man bought some athletic tape. You know where I'm heading with this, right? Mm-hmm. He paid for it, began to leave, then turned back again and asked for a receipt, and he said, just in case. Fill in the blanks of the story and tell us about some of the lessons that you learned and that you shared as you reflected upon this incident at the pharmacy.
And I think I filled in a lot of the blanks, but the filling in the blanks came from our current state of affairs. It would have been just a regular, oh, just in case I want to return it. But unfortunately, in light of where we see ourselves today, I took it completely differently. And again, I can't speak to his intentions, but that's how I understood it. And my understanding of the Black experience in America has grown over the past few years as I got more and more into fighting for justice for my people in Palestine, and understanding that I can't just fight for one just cause, and that if I'm fighting for justice, that work, you know, without diluting one over the other, or one is more important than the other, carries its own set of responsibilities. So I set out to learn more from speaking with my friends from, again, I'm not a black man in America, but I can relate on different levels of how the otherness plays out in our interactions. And so, you know, from reading books to conversations to seeing how things play out and seeing how we reduce the humanity of a person because of their skin color just doesn't sit well with me. And so I wrote this, again, in that under that umbrella of humanizing the label to show that, I feel like I'm going into circles, but let me put it in one clear incident in my mind that it just gave me the aha moment. And you know, and I've been involved in this for many years, but it was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I was listening to NPR, and this gentleman is talking about how he is a 6'3" African American law professor in an Ivy League school.
Yeah.
And he says that when he's walking downtown, he would whistle the tunes of Frozen so that people around him know that he has kids and he's not a threat. And that just blew my mind. I mean, just the fact that you have to put in an effort to think about how you're being perceived, because that could, and it's not just because, oh, I don't want people to think that, you know, I'm this or that. It could be, as we've seen, unfortunately, a life or death matter in certain situations.
He could be laying on a curb with a knee on his neck.
It could, or it could be, you know, just the refused service or whatever. And that just blew my mind. And I knew that to an extent, I do that. A friend of mine many years ago, she commented, she's like, so when you're at home and you're really tired, how is your accent? And Heather, my wife, commented, it gets a little thicker. And she's like, so you're intentionally putting on, you know, the accent in the way that I speak. So I am perceived as intelligent, you know, or that I do certain things because of a response to a stereotype that I know is out there. And I catch myself doing it, and I catch myself doing it for that reason. But it's nowhere near the level that a black man in particular in the United States. And that to me resonated on so many levels. And that to me told me that if I'm ever to get justice in Palestine, I need justice where I live as well. And, you know, to work on the environment that I'm in, because that carries a much stronger message than anything else.
You have been listening to Dr. Ahmed Abdul-Majid, interviewed by Michael Spath at the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and same place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To listen to our permanent archive, to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. إلى بلد مهجرين.